Welcome to KPTZ's Nature Now, a program of information and insights about the natural history of our region. We welcome observations and suggestions from our listeners, care of kptz.org. Hello, and welcome to Nature Now. I'm Kate Dwyer, here today with Deborah Kelso. Last week, we announced that this week's show would be on belly biology, that is, all the creatures you can see on the pilings around Port Townsend if you lie on your belly and look. But due to illness, we have postponed that program and we'll be discussing owls later on in the program.
But first, as always, here's this week's mystery sound. So in Nature News this week, I was astonished to see that red elderberry was in flower. I mean, people have mentioned...
That's very early, yeah.
It's really early. And people have mentioned, oh, things are early, you know, red flowering currant and Indian plum and salmonberry. But those have not really been that early. And it makes you wonder what really triggers inflorescence in certain species. I truly have never seen red elderberry this early in flower.
Well, it would seem some are triggered by temperature and some by light and some by combination thereof. But as a landscaper, and a lot of people keep saying, everything's flowering early. It's not true.
Yeah. No.
But some things are like elderberry. And that's good because a lot of the birds and insects are timed with those flowerings. And if they're all screwy, then it can be bad for those creatures.
Yep.
Recently, I was sitting on Siren's deck one evening when one of these beautiful, unseasonably warm days we've been having, and a couple of otters, river otters, were swimming by. And the guy behind me said, "You hear that? You hear that call?" And I listened, and very, very faintly you could hear this chirp, chirp, chirp. Sounded like a little tiny bird. But he said, "No, they call each other in the water." And I hadn't been aware of that, and I fact-checked it at Cornell, and it's true. We can't play the little sound because it's just too faint, but listen for it next time you see a river otter swimming by. And by the way, any otter you see this far from the ocean are river otters, not sea otters.
Yeah, it is a really cool sound. I have heard it before.
It sounds so unlikely.
Yeah, it does. Another sound that people have been hearing a lot is this. And it's the sound of a flock of pine siskins. Many people have reported that it's a really good year for finches, for both pine siskins and red crossbills. And I was speaking with Jeff Hammerson about this, and he said, well, it's linked to such a great cone crop this year. Douglas firs have produced
really
a bumper crop.
Yeah, hanging with them, yeah.
And so the pine siskins and red crossbills have come in flocks to take advantage of that food resource.
Well, some people are complaining about this drumming sound made by male and female northern flickers. They make this sound by drumming on metal or wood objects. It lasts about a second, during which the bird strikes a tree around 25 times. Drumming in woodpeckers takes the place of singing in songbirds. They are marking territory and looking for mates. If one happens to pick your aluminum gutter for its performance at dawn, we offer you our condolences.
Or our congratulations. I mean, they are taking care of all kinds of insect pests for you, you know, the carpenter ants and termites and all kinds of other...
And there you have the difference between Deborah and I. Now, listen to this. That was the sound of the spotted owl, and that's the main subject of our talk today. Deborah Kelso, my guest and regular producer, has agreed to be our guest to talk about her work with spotted owls. Deborah is a wildlife biologist, besides being a Nature Now producer. So welcome, Deborah.
Oh, thanks very much. I'm not very comfortable on this side of the mic, so I've become rather owl-like over the years, reclusive, and you'll have to...
Lure you out to bring some mice in here to get you to come out of your cavity.
Elicit the proper vocal responses.
Okay. So who do you work for?
I work for Oregon State University. I'm a senior faculty research assistant. It's a unique position that's a cooperative study with the U.S. Forest Service's research lab.
Right. And you've been doing it a long time, right?
I have been. I've been working on the Olympic Peninsula since 1990 and for OSU since 92.
So before we get into spotted owls, how many species of owls are on the Olympic Peninsula?
Well, we're blessed with an abundance of owl species here. We have about 10 species, not all of them commonly. Species like long-eared owls and snowy owls are pretty rare. But we have a variety of different species using a variety of different habitat types on the peninsula. We only get about 8 of them commonly. Mm-hmm. We have a series of small owls. The Saw-Whet owls and the northern pygmy owls and the western screech owls are all considered small owls. Some mm-hmm. of them, the pygmy owls, are about the size of my palm.
Yeah, well named.
And they are something to behold. And then we get into medium-sized owls, which spotted owls are considered a medium-sized owl, mm-hmm. along with barn owls and short-eared owls. And now the barred owl, not to be confused with barn owls.
Right.
A lot of people will have now seen the invasive barred owl.
Yeah, we'll be talking about that.
Yeah.
Quite and a bit later on in the program.
We get great horned owls are our largest owl that we get in mm-hmm. our area, and they have a wingspan of a couple of feet.
What about the calls of these different owls are extremely different. Do we have some clips we can play?
We do, actually. There's the classic great horned owl call, which is what most of the westerns include someplace on the lonely evening by the campfire.
You mean the movies? The western movies?
Yeah, uh-huh. Western movies and horror films, actually.
Let's hear that one.
And then we get like this tooting sound of the pocket-sized Saw-Whet owl, which doesn't sound like an owl at all. It's like a little...
Uh-huh.
And here we'll play a clip from that. And then we get these really wild, raucous, occasionally hair-raising calls of the barred owls, which mm-hmm. a lot of people will have been hearing in their backyards.
Yeah, some of them sound like monkeys.
Yeah, they're outrageous.
Yeah. Well, let's get into the spotted owl now, the northern spotted owl. Why don't we run over their life history?
I work on a long-term demography study, which has been going since 1987, and we originally thought that spotted owls lived to be about 15 years old, but in the wild we found that their lifespan is closer to 20 years, and they usually become mature at about age 3 and start having young, and they mate for life. And they're very wed to a certain core area. They reuse a nest tree year after year. That's why it's so devastating when they
lose
their sight, mm-hmm. because they leave them very vulnerable to predation because they don't easily find another nest tree.
Because they don't make these cavities. They have to find naturally occurring ones? Is that how it is?
Yeah, they do not make nests. Mm. I study owls on the northeast end of the peninsula on Forest Service lands. And in those areas, they're drier than most of their habitat. So they will occasionally use a platform nest. They'll occasionally use like an old nest of a goshawk or a crow. But mm-hmm. generally, they're dependent on finding a cavity, and it has to be a cavity of a certain dimension,
sure.
Which means it has to be an old tree to be big enough to provide a large enough cavity to raise two young in, and right. for the female to sit in there with them. That's a really limiting factor to find a large enough tree that has the right-sized cavity.
And do they require their nest to be very high?
It usually is high, and it's usually in a Douglas fir. I've seen ones that haven't been greater than 20 feet, but usually they're
way up there,
50 feet or more.
Right. Do they have territories? each pair?
They do, and they defend those territories by voice. And the territory size varies depending on how rich the habitat is, how rich in prey. Here on the Olympics, it's about 3,500 acres per pair of spotted owls.
That's huge, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. Because we're on the northern end of their range here.
And the southern end is where?
They do best in central Oregon. That's really their ideal habitat type. Here, it's colder, and the prey isn't as abundant, so they need a larger territory size.
And their prey is limited, right? Don't they just like a few?
On the peninsula, they primarily select flying squirrels. Well, not select, but their primary prey is flying squirrels.
And they're restricted to old growth too, right?
And flying squirrels tend to be in old forest. They'll also use bushy-tailed wood rats and voles and snowshoe hares. There are other components to their diet, but about 70% of their diet consists of flying squirrels.
Wow. And they catch them in midair?
There are a variety of ways that they catch
them. They'll take them any the way they can get them, fried, boiled.
And how you'll know that there's a spotted owl in the area is you'll find just a flying squirrel tail. Because, you know, the tail has no nutritional value. And I don't know how many people have seen a flying squirrel tail, but it's this lovely velvety entity.
Oh, and you'll find it at the base of a tree?
You'll find it at the base of a roost tree. They will have swallowed the rest of the squirrel or pieced it apart and left the tail.
Interesting. Well, before we get into your work and how you do it, let's go back to, as most people know, the spotted owl were in the middle of a huge controversy about protecting old growth forests, and they were listed as an endangered species. In what year was
They were listed as endangered in the state of Washington in 1988, and then they were listed as federally threatened in 1990.
Right.
The man that I worked for, Dr. Eric Forsman, he's a leading scientist, spotted owl biologist, and he was instrumental in first recognizing the link between spotted owls and old growth forests, and the fact this was in the late 60s, and the fact that we were losing old forest apace. You know, the cutting was
rapacious.
Yeah, was rapacious. And that these birds were rarely found in anything but an old forest. So it became very controversial because logging was a primary industry here on the peninsula and in a lot of other places. So back in 1994, they finally recognized how critical this habitat was for these birds that were becoming increasingly rare, and placed
restrictions
on logging and protected habitat as critical for them. And then tragically, just about that time when we were hoping that spotted owls would, that the population would stabilize and increase, then their aggressive cousin, the barred owl, arrived on site, and then they were hit broadside by this impact from barred owls.
And the spotted owl had become in those days a whole symbol for the environmental battles of trying to save old growth forests, and they became a symbol for environmentalists. And it got pretty nasty.
It did. It was. I didn't used to tell anyone what I did in those days. I worked over on the west side. You didn't mention what you did. And spotted owls were just the symbol for the forest. Along with all the other old growth dependent species. So it wasn't just the owl that we were protecting. We were protecting a whole ecosystem.
Yeah, it represented the ecosystem. Yeah. It became an icon, really.
Yeah.
Well, let's talk about your work. Tell us what you do and how you do it. I think it could be fascinating.
I feel really lucky to do the work that I do. I work exclusively on Forest Service land in the northeastern part of the Olympics and the old Quilcene Forest District, Forest Ranger District. We have studied them so long. Like I said, the study's been going since 1987. So we know where the primary territories are. Each year I go out and see if the birds are on site. And I monitor 24 sites, but I'll go out on, there are a few that I, those 24 sites I check three times during the field season.
And these sites are nests, right?
Yes, mm-hmm. they're core areas that have consistently had spotted owls in mm-hmm. the past. I'll go and check if the owls are on site, if they're nesting. We know which birds we're looking at because we've tried to band all of the owls on the Olympic Peninsula. We band them with a unique Fish and Wildlife Service band on one wrist and then a color band on the other wrist, so we don't have to capture them to know who we've got.
It must be hard to see those bands. You just use high-powered binoculars?
It is, yeah. And usually we have mice with us as prey, mm-hmm. and when the owls fly down to catch the mice, we can then see the color band on their wrist.
Is that also how you go about banding them in the first place? How do you catch an owl?
It's a trick. How easy it is depends on how hungry the bird is and how into prey they are usually. It's easier in a nesting year because they're feeding young or they're feeding their mate. But we use live mice as a lure. We stay really still and the owl is focused on the moving mouse, and when they come down for the mouse, then we can grab their feet.
Oh, that sounds tricky.
Yeah, it is. It is tricky.
I hope you have leather gloves on.
I do have some really thin leather gloves. Uh-huh. And the other way we do it is we have a noose pole that's an extendable fishing pole that goes up to about 25 feet high. Then we'll tease the owl mm-hmm. so that it focuses on like a fake squirrel, and while it's watching that, we'll ease the pole mm-hmm. with a noose on the end over its head and then glide it down to the ground.
Wow. Well, when you're trying to figure out if you've found either a new nest or if there are birds in an old nest, do you call to them to discover that?
I try to be really sneaky. I don't want to alert them or alert barred owls now, especially to the fact that there are spotted owls there. So I usually try to look visually. I know the site so well that I look for sign, which is whitewash or pellets in the area. Mm-hmm. Occasionally you can find feathers and
Or squirrel tails.
Uh-huh. So I'll do a visual search first.
But in the old days, before we had this barred owl invasion, you would call to them?
Well, I would usually still try to start with a visual mm-hmm. search just because it's disturbing to an owl. You're basically saying, hey, hey. You know, when you call to them, you're triggering a territorial response in them, but sometimes you can't find them except by starting to call for them.
So I wonder if you would do a call for us, like you would do in the forest.
I would. I would start usually with a little nest whistle, which is like a... And then what they normally do is a four-note call, which is like... And then the female is a little bit higher pitched than that. Uh-huh. You can tell the difference between sexes and owls. Even though the female is slightly larger than the male, she has a higher pitched call.
And you can tell that difference. Oh,
yeah.
Very good. Let's talk about some of the numbers you've discovered. When you first started, or the study that you work on first started, how many owl pairs did they approximate were on the peninsula?
Well, in 1995, they were trying to assess that, and they reckoned that there were probably 300 to 400 spotted owl pairs on the Olympic Peninsula.
And those would mostly be in state forest or national park or federal forest?
Both, all lands. Mm-hmm. I mean, at that time, there were, DNR still had some old forest, and there was some old forest on private land. Now that's virtually gone. Mm-hmm. But the main areas where there was still old growth remaining was Forest Service land and the Olympic National Park.
Uh-huh. Yeah. 300 to 400 pairs.
Yeah.
And now what do you estimate?
It's really devastating. They now reckon that at the most there's like 15 to 20% of what that was, and probably more realistic is like 10% of what that population was like in
You're saying a 90% loss?
Yeah.
I don't think that's well known, is it? What is your...
It's becoming better known.
That's devastating.
And here on the Olympic Peninsula, it's particularly bad in that they're more vulnerable here, being at the northern end of their range.
They're already at the edge.
Yeah,
of their
they're
range.
Already mm-hmm. just barely scraping by. So when barred owls come into the area, they force the spotted owls out of that prime land and up into more marginal habitat, which is higher elevation, rockier,
smaller,
colder,
trees.
Smaller trees.
And that's the areas that you particularly monitor, isn't it?
In the Northeast Olympics, we do have rockier areas, more canyon. Some of those drainages are really deep, and bardels don't really seem to like those areas that well. Most of the sites that I monitor are around 3,000 feet. Bardels tend to like lower elevation forests that are, more in the riparian zone.
Right.
So,
and what are some of the reasons that the bardel are successfully running out the spotted owl? Is it they're just more of a generalist in prey and habitat?
They are. They're cousin of the spotted owl. So they're closely related, but they're slightly larger and they're more aggressive, and they use a variety of different habitat types. They don't just focus on old forest. They'll use...
And they'll eat about anything.
And they'll eat just about anything. I mean, they'll eat amphibians and reptiles and...
Birds.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they have had a large impact on our smaller owls. People have been recording a real decline in the numbers of screech owls and pygmy owls and saw-whet owls, and they think that that's linked to barred owls coming into this area. Well, and the barred owls have really been acting like an invasive species. I mean, they never used to be here. Mm-hmm. They used to be exclusively seen in eastern U.S. forests. Mm-hmm. In the late 1800s, they started making a migration westward. And they theorize it's due to man's activities in the landscape.
Specifically what?
Well, providing them with wildlife corridors in the form of planting trees around urban areas and excluding fire. You know, the North American Indians used to burn those areas on a regular basis. Only you can prevent forest fires.
Right, whole thing. They couldn't cross a big prairie. They just couldn't because they're dependent on trees.
Yeah, they couldn't cross a big prairie. This is a theory. I mean, no one can really prove that. It might be, linked to climate change. There are lots of different reasons why this may have happened, but there's evidence that links it to human activities. So we're somewhat responsible for them
the
being
invasion.
Here. Yeah.
And when did you first see a barred owl on the Olympic Peninsula, or where did somebody see it?
They were first recorded in Washington State in the early 1960s, and here on the Olympic Peninsula, the first record is 1985.
Kind of loss in such a short time.
I know, and they were a novelty then, and then we just started seeing them, and now they are everywhere as residents of Port Townsend.
Didn't you call them the starlings of owls?
Yeah, and they are really cool birds, and it's a wondrous thing to see them, but they are having a devastating impact on spotted owls, which
this must be heartbreaking
for you.
You've worked on this for 30 years or something?
Well, yeah. 25, yeah. Uh-huh. So, yeah, it really does break my heart. So it's a very difficult issue, you do.
Well, there are people doing things about that, but we don't have time to go into that in this program. But thank you, Deborah, for sharing your work. I know you don't like being interviewed, so thank you very much.
Oh, it's a pleasure.
Now we'll hear that mystery sound again. That is the primitive-sounding croak of the great blue heron, the largest heron in North America, with a 6-foot wingspan. In flight, the GBH, as birders often refer to them, typically holds its head in toward its body with its neck bent.
The variable diet of great blue herons allows them to exploit a variety of habitats. This adaptability also enables them to winter farther north than most herons. Fish, amphibians, reptiles, invertebrates, small mammals, and even other birds are all potential prey of the great blue heron. In Washington, much of their winter hunting is on land, with voles making up a major portion of their winter diet.
In events this week, the Port Townsend Marine Science Center's annual auction and party will be at the Commons at Fort Worden this year, on March 14th at Saturday night, 5 to 9 p.m. Come out and support the critical work of the Marine Science Center.
Also on Saturday the 14th, Admiralty Audubon is leading an all-day field trip to the Dungeness Wildlife Refuge. See their website for details.
Well, that's it for this show. A lot about birds.
Yay!
Peep, peep. Next week, more birds when Mary Robson interviews Christy Lassen of Birds Unlimited about the birds of spring. If you'd like to hear this show again, Nature Now repeats at 5 on Thursdays and 11:30 on Saturdays. Recent podcasts are available at kptz.org.
Nature Now is produced by Kate Dwyer and edited by Charlie Fleischman. Production coordinator is Mike Schlexer.
Closing music this week is Who Are You? Performed by The Who.